We're continuing Gilas Ruos, and so she asks him to marry her.
ויאמר ברוכה את לאדוני ביתי היטבת חסדך אחרון מן הראשון.
And here we're going to understand why Boaz didn't take the initiative himself. As he tells her,
לבלתי לכת אחרי הבחורים עם דל ועם השיר.
Your second kindness is even bigger than your first kindness. He blesses her and he says, the first exceptional thing you did was that you converted. And secondly, that you've been waiting around for me? He was sure she'd go after a regular shidduch, one of the younger men. She's young. But no, she says, I'm waiting for you. And her waiting for him is because she realizes that spiritually there's a benefit to continue the family through the family.
Ve'ata biti al tiri kol asher tomri eselach.
So he says, now, my daughter, my girl, don't worry, whatever you say, I'll do for you.
Ki yodea kol shahar ami, ki eshet chaylat.
Because everyone in the Sanhedrin, everyone in the high court knows that you're a woman of valor and that you are capable and you are going to live up to the mitzvos of the Torah. And so I am confident that you are fit to lead my family, whatever family we're going to have. So he says, you're right, I am a relative. But there's a closer relative than me, because remember, he is only the cousin of the deceased. There's still an uncle left, so that's one relative closer. And that's another reason why Boaz had not taken any initiative, because it wasn't his initiative to take.
Lini halayla.
He tells her, spend one more night as a single woman. Tomorrow, Be'ezrat Hashem, we're going to take care of it, this way or that way. And in the morning, if he wants to redeem, so then good. And if he doesn't redeem you, so then I will redeem you. And I swear by Hashem, just as you spoke, that's what's going to be. Just sleep till the morning. And here Chazal have many deep interpretations on this pasuk. And one very important interpretation is that as much as Boaz is talking and saying, we're not going to do anything, we're going to take care of this tomorrow, at that moment he felt like he wasn't going to live up to the test. And that's why Chazal say he swore. He said, I swear by Hashem that stay till the morning, that we're not doing anything here tonight. And Chazal say he swore in order to keep his Yetzer in check, because he started feeling that he was having second thoughts. Wait a second, I'm single, she's single, why wait? And he took a vow, for a man of his stature, taking a vow was keeping his Yetzer in check. He knew once he swore by Hashem's name, he would never do it. And so Chazal say he took the vow to ensure that he wouldn't do it. And this is a very important insight. People think that big people in Torah will never sin, or they don't have a Yetzer Hara, or they have everything under control. No, they have a responsibility to have it under control. They have a Yetzer Hara, and we don't believe in saints. We believe that we have a job to be pious people. We have a job to keep our desire in check, and the laws are there to help us keep them in check, and sometimes we have to take extra steps to keep them in check. But you see, Boaz also had thoughts. A person asked this week, he had all kinds of improper thoughts and he's not sure what he should do with himself. So I told him, you know, it says in the Song of Songs, it says, your teeth are so beautiful and white like the goats coming off the Gilead Mountains. So Chazal tell us, who are your teeth? That's a reference to that unique army that constituted 1,000 men from each tribe, the most pious men of each tribe, because just like the teeth chomped down on the food, so too they went out and fought the Midianites. And they were the most pious of the Jewish people. And what does it say there? It says when they returned from the war, they took all the loot, all the booty, they brought it and dedicated it to God. They said, we want to bring sacrifices. So Moshe said, is it possible that you guys sinned with the Midianite women? So they said, no, but we did fight, and we did have all these women coming out towards us, dressed to entice us, and we are human. So what we saw caused us to think improper thoughts. And so we wanted to bring all the gold and silver that we captured at war as atonement for the thoughts that were improper. So what do you see? You see that the greatness was that they were real, they were true. They said, we did have improper thoughts, and so we want atonement for that. They didn't say, oh, we're perfect. We didn't even think of anything. No. Part of being human is that we sometimes do have improper thoughts. We try to keep them in check. We try not to let them develop. But at the end of the day, that's part of being human. And even Boaz, as great as he was, and we see he merited to be the father of the Davidic dynasty. But he knew himself, and he saw that he could fall. Vatishkav, you wanted something?
I don't know if that's a question, but it's connected. What you're saying about impure thoughts, and obviously they lead sometimes to impure actions. I've been showing sources that you can do everything else. Torah, mitzvah, Shabbos, may 100%. You do that, everything else is rejected.
I didn't show you that.
So it's, you're saying we're only human, but I've been showing sources that said that blocks everything else out.
Well, the sources are talking about, first of all, masturbation. They're not talking about improper thoughts. And secondly, even about that, the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch regarding those halachos say that that's it's really a Zohar.
Zohar.
Right. It's not in the classical text, and Zohar is a Midrash, and we have to appreciate that Midrashim sometimes use terminology that's there to impress upon us how severe an issue is, but that doesn't mean that that's it. Nothing you did is worth anything.
That was the implication that was given.
I understand, but that's like you have the Gemara that says, "Kol ador b'chutzaretz doma k'mishen lo eloka." Anyone who lives in the chutzaretz, it's like he doesn't have a god. Oh, really? So Moshe Rabbeinu never had a god. So all the rabbis in the Babylonian Talmud never had a god. What does that mean? That doesn't mean that. Means you have to understand the severity. It's not
maybe it's there to show the greatness of, if you do the positive thing, that compared to someone who's been in Kusart, being in Israel makes it as if being in Kusart, like, that could be a similar thing, that the greatness of a thing, it shows how great it is to do that mitzvah, but maybe not necessarily that it's whatever, like.
We're given a direction, you know. It's not you can't take it literally. Really? No, you see the continuation of the Mishnah.
Right.
Some don't. I think is if you only learn Torah and you don't do enough kindness. Okay, you have a lot of lines in the Gemara. Nothing. Nothing? His whole life went down the tubes because one time he embarrassed a person publicly? That's it? No mitzvah's worth anything? So obviously it doesn't go that far. It's using terminology to tell us how that it's very, very severe. How exactly it's applied, I don't know. But halachically we don't assume that it's as severe as that. Meaning,
taking something that is basic human drive, and you're saying it's one of the most severe things you can do, but it's also one of the most common things.
So that's why I don't like discussing it here, because I feel that it's unfair to take a person who did tshuva or giyu and start talking to them about the severity of masturbation, because it's hard enough for a person that he has to separate himself from the co-ed world, and we'll use clean language, that a person is accustomed to. You have to be careful not to push a person too quickly, too far. The fact that in the long run a person has to aspire not to do that and realize that it's not positive, that's true. But in the short run, that is definitely the lesser of all the evils. And that's where people sometimes get confused, because they see that medrash and they say, okay, so then let me go do everything else I wanted to do. Who wants this? Right? And that's wrong. Meaning this is the lesser of the evils, to the extent that I don't even mention that. That's what I said. You didn't see it from me, because I wouldn't show it. Because I'm always dealing with the guys who see that, and then they come and they say, oh, wait a second, so I'm such a sinner now. So I say, no.
You're doing anything.
What?
What's the point?
Oh, so then what's the point in doing everything? Right. So then it knocks all the wind out of people's sails. So that's why I don't believe that that's a midrash people should see. I think that does more harm than good. In the long run, a person has to know that that's something that a person should aspire to outgrow. It's something that a person should try to diminish. I always say, like everything, if you're smoking twice a day, try to do every day and a half. Go down incrementally. So every trait that a person wants to change, that they could work on. And this is one which I don't put at the top of the list, because I feel like it's too hard. Once a person's married, it's a different story. But to tell a person to separate from the co-ed world and change all of that, and keep kashrus, and keep Shabbos,
and
live in the yeshiva, and all that. If slowly. But you're not going to succeed in the long run. And I'll tell you, I had an interesting conversation with a teacher from another institution where they do just that. They come, they tell him everything, that's it. So I said to him, 2 weeks ago, he said to me, what do you say when people ask you this? I said, I tell them, I'm not telling you yet. Come back to me in a year or two. You're not yet ready for it. So he said, really? By us, we get students for a week or two. But that week or two, they're fully Orthodox. I said, yeah. What happens a week later? So he said, we don't know. I said, right, you don't know. But that's not a way, that's not education. You know, you got to work with a person slowly. You grow. And I think the success of Machon Mir is in the long run, people stick to it because we're building incrementally. And that's what we saw with Rus also. You can't jump. It doesn't work. We're human beings. And Hashem doesn't expect it. Meaning, that's what we saw last night. So when Naomi saw she's sincere, Naomi said, that's it, I have nothing left to say. I could tell you tremendous stories about guys who were here and they didn't realize that certain things were prohibited, that they were doing on a daily basis, on a Shabbosly basis. They didn't know. The guy who would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to shave in honor of Shabbos. He didn't know. The guy who would light Shabbos candles Shabbos morning too, in honor of Shabbos. He wanted to honor Shabbos more. All kinds of interesting things. Say there, people don't know. The guy who told me that when he started keeping kashrus, so he knew he wasn't allowed to eat meat with milk, and it was so hard, so he started eating only shrimp with milk. That was true stories. I'm very serious. I'm very serious. So I'm saying there's, slowly people grow. It's
What if fish or anything?
I don't know. I never ate shrimp. I don't know. Okay, so we'll conclude the story without the text because we're out of time. Boaz gives her a gift of a certain amount of barley. She takes it home, and there's a sign why he gave her six. Chazal say it corresponds to the six blessings that King David was blessed with. And she comes home, and Naomi tells her, sit tight, because he's going to take care of it today. And Boaz goes to the courts, and he invites Ploni Almoni, the man named Tov, who was his uncle, and was also Machlon's uncle. And he summons 10 people, and he tells them there's a portion of field that Naomi sold, and as a relative, we have a responsibility to buy back that field. Are you interested? You're the closer relative. So he said, fine, I'm interested. So he said, fine, if you're going to buy that, so then there's also Ruth the Moabite, who came back with Naomi, and she also wants to get remarried, and we as relatives are the first that should do that. Are you interested in doing that? And he said, no, I'm not interested in that, because I already have a wife, and I can't marry another woman. I'm going to have fighting in my house. And anyways, she's a Moabite, and who knows what people are going to say about my children afterwards. So they make a deal. And Boaz takes off his glove, and he takes the glove. In that exchange, like we do at a wedding, you take the handkerchief or the glove, and I receive all the rights in exchange for the glove. That's an act that signifies the closing of a deal. And Boaz acquires the right to be the first in line to purchase the fields that were sold by the family and to marry Rus. And he does marry her. And from here we learn that you have 10 people at a wedding, that you have 10 people for Sheva Brachos, because it says he summoned 10 elders, and they bless him, that the woman that comes to his home should be like Rachel and Leah. And that's very interesting, because they were all from the tribe of Judea. Here our sages point out, they came to a recognition that Rachel was the primary strength of the house of Yaakov, and that requires a lot of insight. What's going on here? Why is that? Why is this the point where they realize that? They bless him that his house should be like the house of Peretz. They had a tradition that from the house of Peretz would come forth the great leaders of Israel. Boaz marries her, and she gets pregnant that night, and he dies that night. And so now you have two widows again, Naomi and Rus, and Naomi helps her bring up the child. And we conclude the Megillah with genealogy, from Peretz going all the way down to David. We have a tradition that it was on Shavuos and Shabbos that David passed away, and so we also we read this Megillah that describes David's lineage and also describes how a person can become a true ger, how a person can truly connect to the Torah on this day where we Am Yisrael became true gerim, and we formed a true connection with the Torah.